Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Hey, you ready? Hey, grab that right there. Are you ready? Oh, is you ready?
Ready.
You say you ready?
Oh,
whole squad ready?
Ready.
Is you ready?
Huh?
Are you ready?
Ready.
Is you ready? Whole squad ready. We came here to see Jet. What you got?
No.
Today, Scott sent to me, is the anniversary of something that has become a bit of an icon here on All Marine Radio, and that is the fight of the USS Johnston under the command of Ernest Evans. The Battle of Samar happened in 1943. So what is that, 77 years ago? And again, if you haven't read about the USS Johnston and you don't know who Ernest Evans is, go ahead and check it out. The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors. If you want to hear Tim Lynch lose his mind, get him to start talking about Hornfisher as a writer. The guy who writes it, Tim Lynch will absolutely lose his shit. He will. I kid you not. He loses his mind. So anyway, pretty amazing stuff. And but again, it's an incredible record of naval courage and of the legacy that is the United States Navy. And so, today is the 77th anniversary of Ernest Evans turning his ship around, I think, three different times to attack the Japanese. The first time, he didn't even, you know, he just turns it. Let's go. He knows what he has to do. And second time he turns it, it's already severely damaged. And then he turns it around again, a third time. And because of the courage of the escorts of Taffy 3 off Samar, the jeep carriers and all the aircraft and all that are not annihilated by a much superior-sized Japanese force. So today's, we remember them. So my thanks. All right, I want to, is you ready? That's right. So this is the Aspen Security Forum. This is a segment entitled President Trump's National Security Agenda with Robert O'Brien. Stephen Hadley, who's a former National Security Advisor to President Bush, and Anja Manuel, the Director of Aspen Security Group. So this is them. It started a couple minutes into it, so here you go.
Officer for the UN Security Council Commission. He's also a lawyer from California, the co-founding partner of Larson O'Brien in L.A., and a graduate of the great UC Berkeley and UCLA. Ambassador O'Brien, we're so happy to have you here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Anya, and thank you for that kind introduction. It's great to be here with Ambassador Burns and Stephen. Bring you greetings from the President of the United States. He's off campaigning today, but sends his best. It's tough to do these things by Zoom, so I appreciate everyone hanging in there with us. I'd much rather be out in Aspen. I was there a couple of years ago and had a great time and look forward to a future visit in person. Anya, your backdrop looks great. It looks very inviting for a future a trip out to Colorado.
We hope so.
I look forward to it. So 4 years ago, the president was elected, and he had a very different view of foreign policy, peace and prosperity, and what could be achieved for the American people. And what President Trump does is he puts the needs of the American people first, their values, their safety, their rights. And he also believes, like Ronald Reagan did, that America is best served when we have a peace through strength foreign policy and national security policy. And over the past 4 years, the president has implemented that vision with purpose. We believe, and especially since I've been here, that the administration deals with the world as it is and not as we wish it to be. And we don't turn a blind eye to the conduct of our adversaries or competitors. And we think because of that, the world is a more peaceful place. And we can demonstrate that, I think, with some of the accomplishments that have taken place during the president's time in office. The first is when the president took office, there was a caliphate spanning the Levant in Syria and Iraq, the size of Great Britain. And that caliphate is gone. Its founder, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, as well as the leaders of al-Qaeda in the Yemen Peninsula and in North Africa, have been removed from the battlefield. Over 50 American hostages and detainees held captive in 22 countries have been brought home. NAFTA has been replaced with a much improved USMCA. And working with El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, the president's reduced undocumented immigration from the region by about 85%. We believe burden sharing with our allies is key. And so one of the first things I was able to do as National Security Advisor last December was go to the NATO summit. And at that summit, we secured commitments from our allies over a 10-year period to increase their defense spending by $400 billion. Now, that was pre-COVID, so we'll have to see how that plays out. But we believe the world's safer and Western Europe and the West is safer because of that additional defense spending by our NATO allies. We've ended defense sequestration and rebuilt the U.S. military. The president established the Space Force, which is the first new branch of the U.S. military in 70 years. And it's captured the imagination of our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. And we're seeing a number of young men and women who are looking to cross commission and join the Space Force. So it's exciting. One of the things that's not talked about a lot, and that Anya, I know you and Stephen take note of, is we're working to expand our relationship with two of the great populist democracies that will be important to us going forward, and that's India and Brazil. I actually head to Brazil to meet with President Bolsonaro on Sunday. We had a tremendous trip to India where the president was well received just prior to the real outbreak of COVID in the United States. And we think that those relationships as we move forward are going to be critical. In Indo-Pacific, we try to revitalize our alliances with our treaty allies, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, the Philippines, and Thailand, on the counterterrorism front, but also on maritime security in the South China Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan Strait, and working with them on mineral issues. In Afghanistan, after almost 20 years of war, 19 years of war, we signed a peace agreement with the Taliban. And, that came under some criticism, but we've had a couple of results of that peace agreement with the Taliban. Number one, since it was signed, I believe on February 29th of this year, we have not had a combat death in Afghanistan. We've lost some soldiers and sailors in accidents, but we haven't had a combat death in Afghanistan since that time. We haven't had to go to Dover for a dignified transfer since that time. We're also seeing inter-Afghan negotiations that are taking place in Doha right now, and they're tough negotiations. It's going to be hard sledding for both the government and the Taliban, but we're there to support them. The president has set a timeline for troop withdrawal. We're going to be down to under 5,000 troops within the next month or so, and in the early part of next year, we're going to be down to 2,500 troops. And it has been suggested by some that's speculation. I can guarantee you that's the plan of the president of the United States. It's not speculation. That's the order of the commander-in-chief. The DOD is working on those plans, and Secretary Esper is fully on board and implementing them.
Let me just say this. Speculation, that comment created some ripples throughout the news cycle. And the speculation, that word was used by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So when he says there has been comments by some saying that is speculation, that is pointing the finger straight at the chairman of the Joint. I mean, he's calling out the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right there. So very interesting, and this was a very newsworthy portion of this segment.
We've had a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, and that's brought the regime economically to its knees. What we've done is we've cut off massive amounts of funding going to the Houthis, going to Hezbollah, going to Hamas, going to the Assad regime and going to Khatib Hezbollah and the other paramilitary groups in Iran, in Iraq, because of the pressure that we put on Iran. And that choking off of their ability to create problems throughout the region helped bring us to really a true American breakthrough in the Middle East, where we have countries embracing a better future based on shared interests and values. So last month, the president achieved a historic peace agreement with the UAE, Bahrain, and Israel, the Abraham Accords. And I was fortunate to be on that first commercial flight from Ben Gurion Airport to Abu Dhabi International to begin what we believe is going to be a warm peace as opposed to a cold peace between the Gulf Arabs and Israel. So we made important progress as well in the Balkans on another intractable conflict, normalizing economic relations between Serbia and Kosovo. Again, it was another area that folks said it couldn't be done. It had been worked on for 30 years. And as you may have seen, both the Kosovars and the Serbians are implementing those normalization agreements. The Serbians just reopened a major border and customs checkpoint on the border within the past week. So those are some of the things that we've seen, some of the accomplishments that we've seen happen under the administration. We've also taken the position that we're going to protect American sovereignty. So the president just is not going to stay involved in treaties where one side violates the treaty. For example, the Russians with the INF or the Open Skies Treaty, but we abide by it. We're not going to stay in international organizations that are corrupt or that are totally controlled by the Chinese. If we can't reform them, we'll try and reform them first, but we're not going to stay involved in the Human Rights Council or the WHO where they're fully corrupt. So I think maybe the whole point of this is the idea of leading from behind and strategic patience is something that's been cast aside by this administration. And we think the results are pretty significant. I'll make one quick comment about China, because I think we'll circle back when we talk with Stephen and give him a chance to jump in here. But I think the president has been the first. He talked about this as a private citizen. He's led as president, but I think he's the first president that's recognized the conventional wisdom that all of us probably bought into for so many years, that China over time would liberalize first economically and then politically, was wrong. I mean, we've all watched as we've turned a blind eye to Chinese malign behavior, whether internally or externally, that China's become more nationalistic, more mercantilistic, more authoritarian, and more committed to Marxism-Leninism over time. And now the free world is starting to follow our example of standing up to China, whether it's technology theft, unfair trade practices, intellectual property theft, theft of private data, and that sort of thing. We did come up with a phase one trade deal, which we thought was a terrific deal at the time. Unfortunately, it's been a little overtaken by events with COVID. But we think we got that deal because the president was willing to put strong tariffs on the Chinese. And we can talk more, and I'm sure Stephen will have some more thoughts on China. But just as a summary, I think the president's approach of putting America first, but not America alone, working with our allies, encouraging them to share a bigger share of the burden, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Western Europe, has led to a number of successes, very serious successes that have been overlooked by our friends in the media and sometimes even in our colleagues among the think tank world. So we're very, very pleased with the president's agenda. We think it's something he'll take into the second term. You know, it's going to be a tough election in 18 days from now. Who knows what's going to happen? But we think we think over the past 4 years we've restored a tremendous amount of authority to American foreign policy that was missing at the time that the president came into office. So with that, I could promise being able to turn the microphone over to a lawyer, you could end up with a 45-minute filibuster. So with that, I'll turn it over to my good friend Stephen. And one thing, Stephen, I just want to say at the outset, I've been so appreciative of your wisdom and counsel and your generosity with your time since I've been in this position. You really set a standard for all of us who've come after you. So thank you for that, and thank you for joining me this morning.
Ambassador, thank you so much. Thanks for your kind words. Thank you for your statement. It's a good, concise summary of what the president has accomplished. I would like to focus on what would happen under a second Trump administration. And I want to follow up on some of the items you identified. Let's start, if we can, with China. I think it is fair to say that the administration has awakened both elite opinion and popular opinion within the United States to the challenge presented by China. And many would agree that you have usefully begun a process of pushing back against aggressive Chinese policies, whether economic, military, or diplomatic. A question for you would be this. What, in your view, does the future hold for U.S.-China relations? What kind of relationship should we be seeking with China? Are we strategic competitors? Are we adversaries? Are we even enemies? How would you characterize it? And what's your vision about what we should try to achieve in this relationship going forward?
So thanks, Stephen. That's the biggest question that any of us are going to face, whether it's this administration or another administration come next year. I believe, and I've written about this for years and talked about it for years, that China's truly the challenge, to the United States for our generation. What the president said, and I agree with him, is we'd like to have great relations with China. China is an amazing country. They're hardworking. They're smart. They're diligent. They've been somewhat aligned with the United States for many, many years. We fought in the same side in World War II. And we've had hundreds of thousands of Chinese come through the United States to be educated here. We've got lots of Americans who are doing business and who've lived in China or spent time in China. So we'd like to have a good relationship with China. Unfortunately, what's happened over the past 30 or 40 years is that instead of having, as the Chinese like to describe it, a win-win relationship where both sides win, we've really had a win-lose relationship where China has won and we've lost. And so we've got to crack down on intellectual property theft, for example. And Christopher Wray, our director of the CIA, said that the intellectual property theft of China over the past several decades has been the greatest wealth transfer in human history. We've got to stop that. And we've got to do it from our side. And the FBI is opening a new counter-espionage investigation on China every 10 hours. And we have to get smarter. We have to harden ourselves. We have to make it harder for the Chinese to steal our technology, to steal our intellectual property. We've done that in part through law enforcement, in part by our visa restrictions. We've learned that the Chinese were sending literally thousands of PLA officers to American universities, under the guise of being students, where they could come to the universities and steal our technology and get educated and take our know-how back and rebuild the Chinese military. And so that has to stop, and we're putting an end to it. I mean, I think at one point we probably had more Chinese PLA officers in STEM graduate programs here in the U.S. than we had U.S. military officers in graduate programs here. That's just not, that's not smart. And so look, there's a lot that we have to do on our side. I think what the president did with the tariffs is he finally woke up the Chinese that this endless $500 billion a year trade deficit, where they hollow out our manufacturing jobs, where they hollow out our supply chains and take it all back to China, that's ending. I think we have to reshore and nearshore our critical infrastructure, whether it's healthcare, pharmaceuticals, chip making, rare earths for sure. And that's something we've had a lot of success on over the past 4 years is establishing alternate supply lines for rare earths. So there's a lot that we need to do to protect ourselves going forward. We just haven't, handled the relationship well. And we have to understand that at a minimum, they're strategic competitors. Maybe they're adversaries. I hope they're not enemies. Although I understand that Xi Jinping was telling his troops this morning to prepare for war. A war with China is not a good thing. I've always believed the best way to deter a war with China is through strength. And so if we rebuild the Navy the way the president has set out to do, and we get a 355 ship Navy, if we really do have a pivot to the Pacific, and we start pulling some of our troops out of places like Afghanistan and Iraq and putting them in places like Hawaii and Guam and the Aleutians and Palau and American Samoa and the Second Island Chain, those are all things we can do, I think, to deter the Chinese from believing that they can overwhelm us. But they're on kind of a heady roll right now. They've got a hot little situation with India on the line of actual control in the Himalayas. They're bullying Taiwan again. They've taken over Hong Kong, lock, stock, and barrel. Tibet remains out there. There's if not a genocide, something close to it going on in Xinjiang. So the Chinese are very, very assertive, very aggressive now. They've asserted rights over the entire South China Sea, like it's Lake Tahoe or something. But next to Beijing, and you know, they've taken a vast swath of Pacific that they claim they own. So you know, they're very aggressive, they're very assertive, you know, across all domains in cyber and space, and so we're gonna have to stand up to them. But I honestly believe that if we show strength and if we deter them, that's the best way to avoid war with China. And on the trade front, I think we showed with the phase one deal that if you show determination, that you can end up getting a decent deal with the Chinese. So I'm hoping for good relations with the Chinese going forward. Longer answer than you probably wanted, but there's a lot of malign activity on their side, and we've got to stand up to it.
Let me ask you. Thank you for that. Let me ask you about one area of tension. Are you worried about a confrontation between China and the United States over Taiwan? And is a Chinese military invasion of Taiwan, there's a lot of talk about that now, is that the most likely scenario? Or is it more likely a kind of gray zone scenarios where China combines economic, political, and military pressure to try to undermine and coerce Taiwan? Which is more likely? And is the United States prepared to, with friends and allies, to help Taiwan in the event of such kind of gray zone scenarios from China?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Look, I don't think the Chinese probably at this point want or are likely prepared for an amphibious landing in Taiwan. I mean, they've got a massive number of missiles pointed at Taiwan, so they could probably annihilate Taiwan in a strike. I don't know what they would gain from that. I think they'd lose everything they wanted to gain if they did that, and they'd certainly become pariahs internationally. For just the wanton destruction of Taiwan, I hope they wouldn't consider doing something of that nature. As far as an amphibious landing goes and a military takeover, that's pretty tough to do. I mean, you know, we're dealing with about 100 miles of waterway, and amphibious operations are notoriously difficult. You know, even for us, you know, you go back to you know, you can go back to Napoleon, or you can go to Nazi Germany. You know, both had strong designs on an invasion of the UK over a 12-mile English Channel, and were deterred by obviously the Royal Navy, but also by a relatively small waterway. I think it would be a very difficult military operation for the Chinese to conduct now. Maybe 10 or 15 years from now, they'd be in a better position to do that as they expand. I mean, they're involved in the biggest naval buildup that we've seen since Kaiser Wilhelm tried to create the Kriegsmarine to challenge the Royal Navy prior to World War I. We're seeing something similar from the Chinese with the buildup of the PLA Navy now. Maybe in 10 or 15 years, they'd be in better shape to do it. But even once you get to Taiwan, there are very few landing beaches, you know, four or five that would be suitable. So I think it's a hard operation for the Chinese to do. And then there's always the United States. And, you know, we don't comment about what our military plans are, how would we respond in that circumstance. But we have a lot of tools in the toolkit that could make, you know, if we got involved, that could make that a very dangerous effort for the Chinese to engage in. So that leads us to the second part of your question. You know, do we have a repeat of Kwame and Matsu, you know, from earlier days, from the 50s and 60s? Do you see, you know, landings by the Chinese on islands and an increasing effort to isolate Taiwan diplomatically, maybe some sort of embargo, that sort of thing. And you know, we don't want to see that. I think that the Chinese end up looking very bad in that situation. And I think the entire free world and most of Asia and the Indo-Pacific would be repelled by that sort of conduct by the Chinese. And I think the Chinese would do more to isolate themselves under taking that sort of action against Taiwan than we could ever do in building a coalition against the Chinese. And I think they're pretty smart diplomats and understand what would happen if they did so. So I'd hate to see a gray zone operation, but I think the Chinese are, again, they're smart strategists, and they've shown with their blue water, their blue militia, and they're equivalent of the little green men in the South China Sea, that they certainly have capability and capacity to operate in the gray zone at a very sophisticated level. And so it's something we have to keep an eye on and monitor. You know, what we've told our Taiwanese friends is, knowing all this, whether there's an amphibious landing, a missile attack, a gray zone type operation, they really need to fortify themselves. They've upped their defense spending. I'm told now they're getting closer to 2%, which would be a NATO level. They're not, obviously Taiwan's not part of NATO, but that would be kind of a benchmark. And they probably need to go beyond that, given the buildup of Chinese forces, especially across the Taiwan Strait. But if Taiwan becomes a porcupine, if anyone has been on safari or spent time in Africa, lions generally don't like to eat porcupines. They can, but they prefer not to. And I think Taiwan needs to start looking at some asymmetric and anti-access area denial strategies of its own, and really fortify itself in a manner that would deter the Chinese from any sort of amphibious invasion or even a gray zone operation against them.
Thank you for that. I want to shift to the Middle East for a minute. You pointed out that the president has reduced U.S. troop levels. He's done so fairly dramatically in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. I want to push you on that just a bit, if I might. Many would argue that some level of U.S. troop presence in these countries is critical if there's any chance of obtaining a negotiated peace with the Taliban in Afghanistan, a post-Assad government in Syria, or an Iraqi government that is not totally under the sway of Iran. Do you agree with this assessment of the critical role of U.S. troop presence in these countries? And how committed will a second Trump administration be to achieving these policy objectives in the Middle East?
So I think overall what the president said and what the American people have said is that they'd like to come home from these countries. I mean, we're spending a tremendous amount of money, billions of dollars every month in Iraq, in Afghanistan. We're spending significant amounts in Iraq and Syria. We've got great power competition with our primary competitors, adversaries, with Russia and China. And so, look, ultimately, it's unsustainable for us to be in these countries forever. We've been in Afghanistan for 19 years. I had one senator, a very conservative Republican from a southern state, who's very sympathetic to the troop presence in Afghanistan, tell me there's not one person in my state who wants to stay in Afghanistan. So I think what's happened is I think the American people really want to bring our troops home. I think the president has touched on that. But obviously, we want to do it in a way that assists our allies and our friends in the region. So we've done a couple of things. Number one, we've drawn down the number of our troops. So we're either getting them home back to Europe or to Asia Pacific, where we need them. Number two, we've really increased the involvement of our allies, of NATO. And so for all the criticisms of the president on his relationships with NATO, we have a great relationship. The president has a great relationship with Jens Stoltenberg and with our other colleagues in Western Europe, both at the NSA level, but also at the head of state and head of government level. And so, for example, in Afghanistan, we'll end up going down to 4,500 troops soon. But there are 4,500 additional NATO troops and coalition troops, not all NATO. Some are outside of NATO, Georgian troops, UAE troops and others. But we'll have the same number of troops that we have there supplied by the allies. That's something that we traditionally haven't had. We've always had a coalition component, but not on a one-to-one basis with the U.S. The same thing is taking place in Iraq. We're not quite up to the number of U.S. troops in Iraq, but we have a very robust NATO presence now in Iraq. And so we're trying to bring our troops home. We're trying to increase the burden sharing with our allies, especially our NATO allies in those countries. And then third, we're watching things as conditions develop, and we're encouraging peace negotiations and among the parties, whether it's in Afghanistan, we're trying to do what we can on the peace front in the Middle East. And we hope that those conditions will allow us to bring everyone home. There's always going to be some sort of a CT component to what we do in the Middle East and Afghanistan. It's a little tougher to do that over the horizon, but we have capabilities and we've shown that. I think there's been a relentless attack on Al-Qaeda and on ISIS over the past 4 years. Taking out leadership and degrading their ability to conduct operations. So I think there's going to be a long-term CT cooperation with whether it's our allies in Syria, whether it's with the Iraqi government, the Afghan government, even in a coalition government in Afghanistan. We've had indications from our adversaries in the Taliban that they'd like to see CT cooperation in Afghanistan. I don't think they like fighting ISIS-K any more than we do. So I think there are some opportunities there, and I think working all of those different lines will allow us to reduce our presence. But as of now, we maintain a presence in those countries. We think it's important, but ultimately the goal is to get American troops back to the United States to the extent we can.
Let's stay in the Middle East for a minute and shift to Iran. The administration has recently ramped up its maximum pressure campaign against Iran. What are the prospects, in your view, for some kind of negotiations with Iran in a second Trump administration? What would be the range of subjects the administration would like to negotiate on? And where would U.S. policy go if Iran refuses to negotiate in a second Trump administration?
So again, great questions. I think it's going to be very difficult for the Iranians to refuse to negotiate. Right now, they're waiting us out. We're being told that by even, you know, countries that are friendly with Iran, and even countries that aren't friendly but maintain diplomatic relations. The Iranians are waiting to see what happens on election day. It's been reported, I'm not breaking news here, that Iran would very much prefer a different administration. They'd like to go back to the JCPOA days. Those were the kind of halcyon days for the Islamic Republic. And we won't go there if the president's reelected. So we'll have to wait and see what happens on the election. But I do think if the president's reelected, the economic pain that's been inflicted on Iran right now is grave. I don't think they'll be able to sustain it much longer. But you never know with sanctions. I mean, countries can be resilient if they're willing to shoot protesters in the street and use the full strength of their internal security forces, which Iran has shown its ability to do. But we think that the economic pressure is so great that after the election, you know, they can hang in there for another month or two. We don't think they can hang in there for another 4 years. So I think that they're going to come to the table. And look, at the table, we need to see a couple of things. We need to see a dismantling of their nuclear program, which didn't happen under JCPOA. It was there. They were still spinning centrifuges, and now they're spinning more once we got out. We have to get rid of that program, a peaceful civilian program with parameters on and guidelines around it is something that could be on the table. But this nuclear program that's held in reserve in bunkers underground, either so a nuclear program can be started in secret or it can be rapidly spun up if Iran doesn't like the way the West is behaving, that's not an option. Long-range ballistic missiles, whereby Iran can threaten Europe or even the United States, that has to be off the table. And support for terrorists in the region have to be off the table. But what we suggest is that, you know, the Iranian people are great people. They're hardworking. They've had a vibrant middle class. I come from California, where, you know, there's a massive, successful, very affluent Persian community, Persian American community. Iran has unlimited potential if the regime would unlock it for its people. And the president said that we can make a great deal with Iran, and Iran could have a very prosperous, happy future. And so I hope that they'll come to the table and do so in a reasonable fashion.
Let's move to another country of nuclear concern. So far, Kim Jong-un has kept his promise to President Trump that he will not test nuclear weapons or long-range ballistic missiles, but he's continued to expand his nuclear weapon and ballistic missile programs and has recently threatened to abandon his self-imposed moratorium. If he does, what would be the U.S. response? And more generally, what would be American strategy towards North Korea at this point? Is complete denuclearization of North Korea really beyond reach at this point, in your view?
Yeah, so that's the question of the hour, and it's a tough one. I don't want to speculate on what we would do if Kim Jong-un changed behavior. We do appreciate the fact that in, you know, since the Singapore summit, there has not been a nuclear test. There has not been a long-range ballistic missile test. There's been some positive language because of the cordial relationship that was developed between the president and Kim Jong-un. But at the same time, we put on sanctions and enforced sanctions the way no administration has in history. So you've got this interesting situation where the president has had very cordial communications with Kim Jong-un, Chairman Kim. But at the same time, we've had a maximum pressure campaign on North Korea to let the North Koreans know that we're very serious about our concern with their ballistic missile program and their nuclear program. So we'll keep that up. Again, I'm hopeful that after the election, once the North Koreans realize that there is no other option, that we'll have a chance to negotiate. But this has been a problem that's bedeviled, you know, every administration since, you know, I've been in and out of government, whether it was the Clinton administration or the the Bush administration, the Obama administration, currently our administration. I think that the president has achieved results that no one thought he could because we've had the toughest sanctions in history on North Korea that are being enforced. And at the same time, he's developed a channel of communications with the North Korean leader. I just had my South Korean counterpart here last week, and Director Suh, and I think they're happy with. I think the South Koreans are happy with where we are, but we'd really like to see some progress. There, you know, there may be an opportunity next year if, and I think we're all hoping that with COVID potentially abating next year, we can have the Olympics in Tokyo. And I think the North Koreans are interested in participating in the Olympics in Tokyo. There might be a season either before or during or after the Olympics where the parties could come together and have some negotiations that led to some prosperity and better economic times for the North Korean people, the people of the DPRK, and also led to some arms reduction and some initial steps towards denuclearization. But it's a tough problem set, as you know, and we're working it hard. And the North Koreans, notwithstanding the cordial conversations between the leaders, their negotiators are, as Steve Biegun has found out, and Alex Wong, they're tough, hard-nosed negotiators, and they don't give a lot. So, you know, we're engaged in the process, and we're going to keep working it.
Appreciate your answers. Appreciate your being with us today and this conversation. We're now going to go to some Q&A from our audiences. So let me turn it back to Anya Manuel. But Ambassador, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you so much, Ambassador O'Brien, for those. You know, you're extremely busy, and you have a real mastery of all of the topics that we're talking about here. I'm going to turn it over to Executive Director's prerogative and let Nick ask the first question, and then we'll go to our audience. Thanks.
Great. Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We appreciate it. As you know, we're nonpartisan. We want to be talking and listening to people from both sides of the aisle. I have a question about the issue of democracy and human freedom. We saw this summer the Chinese smothered the democracy of the people of Hong Kong. We've certainly seen the Uyghurs put into concentration camps by the Chinese government. We've seen people in Belarus out every weekend demonstrating by the hundreds of thousands for human freedom. The State Department has spoken out, Secretary Pompeo and his people, very clearly in opposition in all three cases. President Trump is not. I have certainly not seen that kind of compelling statement by the president on Hong Kong. Your predecessor, John Bolton, wrote in his book that the president actually gave a green light to Xi Jinping on the Uyghurs. Why hasn't the president spoken out? You can imagine President Reagan, President John F. Kennedy, nearly every previous American president would have had a lot to say about the defense of human freedom. Thank you.
No, thanks, Ambassador. And so I think part of this is the problem is that the press just isn't covering a lot of what the president is doing if it doesn't fit their narrative. So I'd refer you back to the Rose Garden speech. I think it was May 20th on Hong Kong. So as soon as the national security law was passed in Hong Kong, the president and a number of us went out with him to the Rose Garden, and he gave one of the toughest speeches on China that we've had of any administration, of any president in history, decrying what was happening in Hong Kong. We've taken specific action, which most of our allies have not done. The Brits have been pretty good on this, but we sanctioned Chinese leaders and we sanctioned Hong Kong leaders that were involved in ending democracy for the people of Hong Kong. The president's made it made asylum seeking by Hong Kongers who want to get out of Hong Kong easier to do. And we had a G7 head of state statement on Hong Kong. So there was an extensive amount done on Hong Kong from sanctions to ending special privileges for the Chinese because of Hong Kong to a very robust public statement and on Hong Kong in the Rose Garden. So, you know, I think we've probably done more than any other country. Even Boris Johnson has been incredibly thankful for what we've done with Hong Kong. I think we've done more to raise the issue of the Chinese breach of the Sino-British Declaration, which is on file at the UN and deposited there as if it were a treaty. and the Chinese breach of it, I think we've done more than any other country, maybe save Britain. Britain's had some, has given some very lenient immigration rulings and status to people from Hong Kong. And by the way, I think it'd be great if we had more immigrants from Hong Kong. I mean, they're terrific people. Everyone who's been to Hong Kong and spent time there, it's sad what's going to happen. I mean, Hong Kong is being fully absorbed into China. But I'd love to see more. If some of these great people from Hong Kong wanted to come to the U.S., I'd love to get some of them instead of going to London. I'd love to see them in L.A. or San Francisco or New York. So those are things that we're working on with Hong Kong. With respect to the Uyghurs, I think actions often speak louder than words. And we've sanctioned companies that are Hikvision and others that are involved in the surveillance society and are involved in putting Uyghurs in re-education camps. We've sanctioned individual Communist Party members in China that are involved in the Uyghur suppression. By the way, no other Western country has done this. So when you talk about our administration versus other countries that are concerned about human rights, we've been leading out with the Europeans and naming and shaming the Germans and others who refused to speak out on the Uyghurs. We just intercepted massive numbers of hair products that came in where the Chinese are literally shaving the heads of Uyghur women and making hair products and sending them to the United States. We're intercepting those at the border through Customs and Border Patrol and extensive enforcement, excuse me, because of what's going on in Xinjiang, and the president has spoken out on the Uyghurs. So again, the narrative, you know, what's actually happened, which is more than any administration's done and more than any of our allies are doing, and we're leading out both on Xinjiang and on Hong Kong with our allies, and we're not getting credit for it, which is a little unfortunate. And then the last thing on Belarus, Belarus is a tough situation. The EU has taken more of a lead, as you know, Ambassador, with Belarus. We're fully supporting it. I'm in touch with my, you know, colleagues, my national security advisor colleagues at our major European allies, but also with the Swedes, with the Baltic countries. And you know, we're doing what we can to support the environment there. But it's a difficult situation where, you know, it's a country that Russia considers in its sphere of influence. So we want to help them, but we want to avoid at the same time triggering some sort of a crackdown on the protesters. Right now, the protesters are demonstrating incredible bravery, going out in the streets every weekend, as you mentioned. And we certainly support their rights, and we support democracy, you know, across the board in Belarus. But at the same time, we don't want to come in and be accused of fomenting another color revolution that would give license to the Russians or Lukashenko or someone to crack down on these protesters. So we always support peaceful and democratic protesters, and I think the folks are demonstrating incredible bravery in Belarus, and we're actively involved in everything that the EU is doing to support the people of Belarus. And I think we had some sanctions come out from the EU on Belarus just recently, and I think you're going to see we've got processes going on here that we're taking a look at that issue as well as other issues. The problem that we have with the Russians is there's not a lot left to sanction. I mean, that our trade is diminished to a level that, you know, we've sanctioned, I think, 300 entities and oligarchs in Russia. We've sanctioned all the energy companies. There's not a lot left we can do on the sanctions front with Russia, but we're looking for additional places where we can show our displeasure, but it's getting hard to do because of the comprehensive nature of the sanctions we have on them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ambassador O'Brien. We'd now like to turn to Dervla Doyle, who is the head of the political section of the EU delegation of the United States. It usually takes just a minute for people to pop up on screen.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Dervla.
Hi, okay, great. Well, thanks very much to Aspen, and thank you to the National Security Advisor for the very clear presentation, and also for the comments on Belarus, which I fully agree. I think the cooperation's been very good, and it was great that we were able to do the coordinated announcement recently on sanctions. So staying maybe in Eastern Europe, my question would relate to Russia, and you have obviously been playing a role recently with regard to arms control. I know that you met with your Russian counterpart at the beginning of October in Geneva, and I think it was described as perhaps a gentleman's deal on what we understood to be maybe a temporary or a limited extension of New START. Obviously, that deadline is coming up quite soon next year. Marshall Billingsley spoke earlier this week at Heritage, And I think the Russians are disputing the fact now that there is actually a deal out there. So I would just be interested in your perspective on this, what you think was agreed, and whether you foresee any further contacts at your level in the period ahead with a view to extending New START. Thank you.
No, thanks for that question. And for everyone who's been engaged in the negotiation with the Russians, you know how easy that is. Look, we made a proposal. It was a relatively straightforward proposal that we extend New START for a year, and that the Russians cap their nuclear warhead number for a year. We thought we had some favorable movement on that front. Marshall has been working. Marshall and his team went to Helsinki right after my meeting with Patrushev, General Patrushev, in Geneva, and we were hopeful that we'd get some traction. We thought it was a very fair deal because what we'd like to do, although we withdrew from OST and the INF treaty because the Russians were violating both of them, we were hoping and are hoping to get a terrific arms control deal, long-term arms control deal. At one point, we wanted to get China involved. The Chinese are so busy building nuclear warheads and building their military that they're not interested. And I think, you know, there's limited pressure the Russians can bring on them to come to the table. But we were prepared to go forward with a U.S.-Russia arms control deal. We'll see if they get back to us and what the response is. It very well may be that the Russians don't respond and continue to build warheads and refuse to a short-term freeze. And we'll take that into account. We thought we made a really fair, terrific proposal that would have given the parties another year or so to negotiate an overall big deal. And we'll see if the Russians take it or not. You never know with the Russians, but we thought we did something that was fair. And so we're hopeful that we'll have some progress there. But it may be that, like other countries, the Russians are waiting to see what happens. And apparently we've got something going on here in 18 days that's causing folks to take stock of their negotiating position. So we'll see what the Russians do. But negotiating with Russia is never easy. They're very skilled. They're very tough, and they always put their view of Russian interest 100% first, and we'll see what they think their interests are here. So we'll have to wait and see and see how that plays out.
They certainly are tough negotiators. It's a dangerous situation. I've got one more question from a European, and that's Ed Luce from the Financial Times. Ed?
Great. Hi, sorry about that. Thank you, Anya. Thank you, Aspen. Thank you, Ambassador, for your remarks. I want to just go back to what you said at the beginning and also something in response to Stephen Hadley about Afghanistan. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, said that you were speculating when you announced there would be only 2,500 American troops left in Afghanistan at the end of the year, implying that it would remain conditions-based and could be as high as 4,500, which is where it is now, I believe. And then the president said it would be zero by Christmas. So there's sort of three different answers there. In the context of very fraught negotiations, as you mentioned, between the Taliban and the Afghan government, and indeed a Taliban resurgence in Helmand and elsewhere. So my question is, since everyone else is speculating now about which the correct answer is, and the correct answer is quite an important piece of information, which should we believe, and why is there such confusion?
Well, listen, the first thing I'd say is when I speak and talk about troop levels and that sort of thing, I'm a staffer. I staff the President of the United States, so it's not my practice to speculate. So other people can interpret what I say as speculation or not, but I wasn't speculating then. I wasn't speculating today. And so that's when I'm speaking, I'm speaking for the President. And I think that's what the Pentagon is moving out and doing. So that's number one. Number two, the president put out a tweet shortly after I spoke at, I think it was at UNLV Law School is when I made those comments. And the president put out a tweet and said, we'd like to have people home by Christmas. And I think what the president was doing is he was expressing the same desire that I think every president since the Revolutionary War has said, whenever we're at war, whether it was a Revolutionary War, or the Civil War, or World War One, or World War II, all presidents, all GIs want the troops home by Christmas. There are a plethora of letters and thousands of letters going back. The troops always want to be home by Christmas. We want the troops home by Christmas. The president wants them home by Christmas. And what I've said on this, and I think the president has said as well, look, we'd like the troops out as soon as possible. We need to get out of Afghanistan. We need to stop spending the kind of money that we're spending in Afghanistan. We need the Afghan people to come together after 19 years. We've done a great job of degrading al-Qaeda, which was the reason we went to Afghanistan to begin with. We want to make sure that Afghanistan is not a place where terrorists can plot against the United States and have safe haven where they can launch attacks against us. So we want to make sure that's the case. But ultimately, Afghanistan has to be run by the Afghans, and the Afghan people have to come together and come up with a solution for Afghanistan. We want to support it. We've been supporting it for 19 years. We continue to support it. We continue to have troops there. But ultimately, if these inter-Afghan negotiations could work out well, there'd be nothing greater than have our troops home by Christmas. But right now, we're on a path with our European allies. So we went into Afghanistan together. We're going to come out together. We're on a path right now that looks like about 4,500 this fall, and a smaller number in January or February. But if the conditions permit it, look, we'd love to get people out earlier, and I think that's the desire that the president was expressing. But the Afghan people know that we're with them, and we've been very supportive of the government and the negotiations, and with our allies, we're going to continue to support the people of Afghanistan as they seek an accord that brings this 19-year war to an end.
Thank you, Ambassador Brian. Let me ask you one quick one, and then I think we have the ambassador of Iraq to the U.S. as he's coming up. I know, just one quick one for you, I know John Bolton, your predecessor, and John Kelly have both said that there was internal discussion that the president mentioned several times wanting to pull out of NATO. And I know that has a lot of people worried. What do you see the U.S. relationship being in a second Trump administration?
So I've never heard that, and I spent a lot of time. I spent a lot, the president's on the road today, but when he's in the White House, I spend a lot of time with him every day he's here. I've never heard him talking about getting out of NATO. There's been a lot of frustration that we were paying more than our fair share for NATO, and that NATO wasn't bearing the burdens that we were bearing in Afghanistan, Iraq. And I think what we've seen, he's got a great relationship with Jens Stoltenberg, who's actually, I think, he and the president of more than professional colleagues. I think they're very friendly and have become friends. And I work with the Secretary General regularly. We've got great relations with whether it's President Macron or Prime Minister Johnson or Chancellor Merkel, with Prime Minister Comte, with our key NATO partners. And so I think what we've done is rather than get out of NATO, I think we've strengthened NATO. I think the amount of money that is being spent by non-U.S. NATO allies on defense is tremendous and terrific, and is a great accomplishment that the president pushed. And every president since I've been involved in politics, since Ronald Reagan, in fact, I went back and found an old Ronald Reagan pamphlet that talked about the Europeans spending more on their own defense. This was going back to, I think, Reagan's 76 campaign. Every president has asked for that. No one's got it except this president. And then I think you see the commitment of troops to Afghanistan and Iraq by NATO has been impressive. So I think we've strengthened NATO. I think the president's been shown a tremendous commitment to NATO. It may be a little unorthodox in the way that he speaks and the way he negotiates. May not be the traditional beltway foreign policy establishment approach to negotiations, but I think the results have been terrific.
Thank you very much. And I know you have a hard stop, Ambassador O'Brien. Do you have time for one more question from the ambassador?
Only for the ambassador from Iraq, and then we'll wrap it up. But thank you, Anya.
Thank you, Ambassador. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thanks, Ray.
I want to thank the Aspen Strategy Group for this invitation, and I'll go straight to my question. Will there be a PEPFAR equivalent for COVID?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I think we've done something. We're doing something similar to PEPFAR. In fact, I think we're even using a lot of the PEPFAR labs. We just announced two things. Number one, the president has made it very clear that the money that we're not going to spend on the WHO, upwards of $400 million, we're going to spend going to frontline healthcare providers around the world, whether it's Africa, Asia, Latin America, Middle East. That money is going to be spent, and it's going to go right to the frontline workers. It's not going to go through Geneva. There's not going to be some takeout of a UN bureaucracy where it goes through that. That money is going to go directly to the people that need it most, like we do with PEPFAR. PEPFAR has been the most successful, and this is something that I know Anya and Stephen, and this is really a credit to the Bush administration, and I know you were both. Ambassador Burns, we're all heavily involved in launching PEPFAR, and I don't think there's ever been a more successful healthcare program launched by any country in history than PEPFAR. And so, one of the things that Ambassador Burks, Dr. Burks, is working on is trying to take some of the infrastructure that was built up for PEPFAR in Africa, but not just in Africa, and using that infrastructure for pandemic response. We've just announced that we're going to be building a pandemic response institute in Africa, in South Africa. We're going to put several hundred million dollars into it. And we're partnering with historically black colleges and universities that have medical schools. I believe there are six of them that have medical schools to make them the lead partners with our with the researchers and the folks who are going to be on the ground at the institute in South Africa. And we're going to, I think the number on that is $200 to $300 million that the administration is committed to it. So both with the new money for the pandemic response unit in Africa, for the WHO money that will now be diverted to frontline pandemic response, and the money that's already in PEPFAR that's created this tremendous infrastructure in Africa. And again, I can't thank, I had a much smaller role than Anya or Nick or Stephen did in the Bush administration, but I can't thank my colleagues there enough for what they did in launching PEPFAR. That investment didn't just help with HIV/AIDS. It's going to actually help with pandemic response in Africa and beyond. So, Ambassador, long answer to your question, and the answer is yes. And I think it's going to be something that's quite impressive.
That's really promising to hear. Thank you so much, because, of course, the pandemic is front of mind. And so it's appropriate to close with that particular question. Ambassador O'Brien, thank you so much. We know your time is scarce and precious. You've really given us a lot to think about, and we appreciate you being with us, and I'll let you sign off. I just want to make a few announcements on behalf of the Aspen.
How about that? I'll tell you what, man. I absolutely enjoyed that entire thing. The Aspen Security Forum, and I'm a huge fan of I mean, I'm a huge fan of that kind of stuff, you know. And again, I smart people, articulate questions, articulate discourse. I mean, come on, great stuff. We don't have enough. I mean, compare and contrast that with the normal shit that you get, through your television on a nightly basis. It's a joke. So I don't know. Somebody's got to do something that is supported. Commercially around the country that is quality, high quality, informative stuff that stops the narrative nonsense. Again, Philadelphia, who knows, might go, what is it, West Philadelphia? Might go up in flames tonight, or a part of Philadelphia might go up in flames, right? The problem is the facts don't meet, right? The facts don't meet the fucking narrative. The guy comes at police with a knife. What are they supposed to do? Oh, well, Mac, they're supposed to get their taser out. Okay. What happens if they don't? What happens? I don't know exactly what the use of, that is, how that's choreographed. If you're by yourself, I would never pull my taser out first. If I'm with somebody, when we get out and we begin to close with the guy, if I'm experienced, maybe I say, hey, get your taser out. You've got the taser, right? I've got a pistol. And you could drop your taser and pull your pistol like that. So that's how we're going to go do this shit. I don't know, right? I don't know. But I know this. When somebody comes at you with a knife, and looks like they mean business, it's not the cop's fault, right? hunting black men. It's bullshit. So, anyway, again, the Philadelphia police have not had a press conference. By now, something's definitely wrong. Something's definitely wrong. So, on that note, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Tune into hour one, and you'll hear news. You'll hear a discussion about when this is all over, then what? No matter who wins, then what? Will the media go back to reporting the facts? I don't think that's going to happen. And that's not a good thing. So on a Tuesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, out.